WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today marks the first anniversary of the Siege of Sarajevo. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Tom Jelton about his experiences covering the civil war in Bosnia. Jelton is a foreign affairs correspondent for NPR. He just won a George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism for his report on a massacre of Muslim men in central Bosnia. Jelton also covered the war in the Gulf and conflicts in Central America, but this has been a particularly dangerous war for journalists. Tom Jelton on the war in Bosnia, coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton indicated today that he's open to a compromise on his $16 billion economic stimulus package, but he also accused Senate Republicans of playing politics. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a joint news conference with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, Mr. Clinton said he'll soon have a proposal to break the deadlock in the Senate.
I'm going to work on a proposal that I think will address some of the legitimate expressed objections. And we will see when the Congress comes back whether the Republicans are committed to putting the American people back to work or just playing politics.
The Republicans say the plan has too much pork barrel spending. Democrats say the program is essential for job creation. Senate leaders have agreed to delay debate on the stimulus package until April 20th, when lawmakers return from their Easter recess. The agreement buys the leaders time to search for a compromise and gives each side an opportunity to build public support for their respective positions. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The jury in the Rodney King civil rights trial has been shown a videotape of Officer Theodore Briseño's testimony from last year's state trial. Briseño is one of four Los Angeles police officers who are accused of violating King's civil rights by beating him during a traffic arrest in 1991. Prosecutors wanted to show the tape because Briseño said that he thought his fellow officers were out of control during the incident. Defense lawyers rested their case in this trial without testimony from Briseño or two of his co-defendants. Ukrainian officials have told a group of visiting U.S. congressional representatives that Ukraine is still committed to ratifying the START 1 nuclear reduction treaty. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
After 2 days of meetings, a 14-member delegation from the House of Representatives says it has received assurances from Ukrainian leaders of their continued commitment to becoming a non-nuclear state. House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt, who is heading the delegation, told reporters in Kiev, the Ukrainian capital, that Ukraine intends to adopt both the START 1 and the nuclear non-proliferation treaties. For months now, Ukrainian officials have been repeating this assertion to any Americans who would listen, but sentiment has been growing in the Ukrainian parliament against the treaties. Just yesterday, Russia accused Ukraine of reneging on its pledge to dismantle the 176 strategic missiles stationed on its territory. Today, senior Ukrainian officials denied that Kiev was seeking to take control of these missiles. Kiev is insisting on security guarantees and substantial compensation before it proceeds on its commitment to nuclear disarmament. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
The stock market closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about a point and a half to close at 3,377.6. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 290 million shares. This is NPR. Voters in Wisconsin are deciding whether their state school superintendent will be an advocate of school choice. One of the candidates in the race for school chief is Linda Cross, a teacher who believes that parents should get public money if they choose to send their children to private schools. Cross is running against John Benson, a longtime school administrator. Cross has received money and support from prominent conservatives, including publisher William F. Buckley and former Education Secretary William Bennett. Wisconsin voters are also choosing a representative to replace Defense Secretary Les Aspin. Winners of today's party congressional primaries will face each other in a special election in May. St. Louis voters are casting ballots for their first new mayor in 12 years. For member station KWMU, Andrea Murray reports.
The Democratic candidate has won every mayoral election here for over 40 years. But if St. Louis is known as a staunchly Democratic city, it's also considered by many to be a racially polarized one. So it was to the surprise of some residents that parts of traditionally white South St. Louis turned out last month to help elect an African-American, Freeman Bosley Jr., as Democratic mayoral candidate. Bosley ran a campaign calling for an end to the influence of special interests at City Hall, which some voters felt had marked the 12-year administration of outgoing Democratic Mayor Vincent Schemel. Bosley's favored to win easily over his Republican, Independent, and Socialist opponents. Though Bosley himself is downplaying predictions of a landslide, many St. Louisans are already considering what change the city's first African-American mayor may bring. For National Public Radio, I'm Andrea Murray in St. Louis.
NASA says it will make a second attempt to launch the space shuttle Discovery early Thursday. The launch planned for early this morning was abruptly halted 11 seconds before liftoff when a computer detected an improperly positioned engine valve. Engineers later said the problem was actually a faulty sensor. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today marks the first anniversary of the Siege of Sarajevo. A year ago today, Serbs fired on a peace and national unity demonstration outside the Bosnian parliament, killing several of the demonstrators. Since then, an estimated one out of every six residents of the city has been killed or wounded. My guest Tom Jelton has been covering the war in Bosnia for National Public Radio. His extraordinary reports have made many of us stop whatever we're doing to listen. He's briefly back in the States, where he just received a George Polk Award for excellence in reporting. Before we talk about what it's been like for him to cover the war, let's hear an excerpt of one of his pieces. This was recorded last summer in Sarajevo, in the home of Ivan and Gordana Knezovic. He is a professor. She's an editor of a Sarajevo newspaper. She was continuing to go to work in spite of the siege.
Gordana and Ivan and others in Sarajevo who stubbornly continue to go to work in the midst of artillery bombardment and sniper fire say they do so as a form of resistance. The enemy, Gordana says, is determined to bring life in Sarajevo to a halt. So refusing to stop working, in Gordana's case putting out a newspaper day after day, becomes a way of defying the relentless shooting. There have been days, Gordana says, when the only two things sold on the streets of Sarajevo were bread and her newspaper. But she finds it's becoming more difficult, not because it's any more dangerous to get to work. Rather, it's getting harder and harder just to think clearly. Gordana says she's losing the ability to analyze facts, to assess each day's developments, to look back and to look ahead.
I think that the worst part of it, that we lost any sense of time. And every day, I'm asking 10 times a day, which day is it today? And I can't remember which day in the week it is, and which date in the month it is, and I can't even remember which month it is. And if you want me to be very honest, I almost forgot which year is this. We lost any sense of seasons in the year, and we lost any sense of the future. I mean, I don't know when the spring was finished, and I don't know when the summer started. And there are only two seasons now. There is a war season, and somewhere in the world there is a peace season. Not for us here. No.
What do you think, Ivan?
Ne znam, nisam siguran. Šta izdvojit? Šta budi?
Maybe we should turn the light down.
At this explosion, we get up from the kitchen table and move to the next room, further from the windows.
About 6 months after that report, when living conditions had further deteriorated, Tom Jelton reported on another middle-class family in Sarajevo, the Madatskis. We'll hear about them a little later. Tom Jelton has kept in touch with the Knezovic family, the couple in the tape excerpt that we just heard. I asked him how they were doing.
They are holding up fairly well. Gordana is the deputy editor of Oslobođenje, which is Sarajevo's leading daily newspaper. And one of the things that she said to me is that those people who have jobs, places to go every day, meaningful work to do, are among the luckiest because it gives them a kind of a reason for keeping on every day, something to focus on, something to get their mind off the daily depressing routine of looking for water and firewood and food and so forth. So she has held up very well. Ivan, her husband, has not done so well, I'd have to say. He stays at home a lot of the time. He was a philosophy professor at Sarajevo University and is used to a very rich intellectual life. It's been very hard for him and for other people like him who have been deprived of conversations, of the atmosphere of a university, of rich intellectual discourse and so forth. Now they are living what is essentially like a Stone Age existence. I mean, look, going out every day and having to gather firewood, you know, outside and water and so forth. And it's been very hard for him. It's also been hard for their son, Boris, 13 years old. When I was there last summer, he was getting together with his friends every day down in the cellar or outside the front door and playing guitar, playing games. I noticed when I was back now that he was spending most of his time indoors. He wasn't going out to find his friends anymore. His mother and his father actually are very concerned about him.
What about the Medutsky family? And that's the family who you described boiling their wash in their former garden.
Yeah, that's a family that I did a profile of that family because I thought they exemplified what has happened to Sarajevo, which is formerly middle-class people, professional people with lives that with which we would find a lot in common ourselves. I mean, Yugoslavia in general, and Sarajevo in particular, is not some third-world setting. It was a very modern, cosmopolitan place. And that family had a beautiful apartment with beautiful furnishings and nice clothes and music and books and so forth. And as I reported in that piece, they are now boiling their clothes in over an open fire and chopping down the trees in their garden for firewood and actually tearing up the floorboards in their own apartment for fuel. And I first met that woman at a soup kitchen where she was standing in line with other people with her tin pot ready to get her three allocated portions of soup. And that is humiliating enough. It's not only humiliating, it's very dangerous because these soup kitchens are often targeted by the Serb forces in the hills around Sarajevo who drop artillery shells onto the city. So it's, from several points of view, it's very difficult for these people to go do that. And that was where I met her.
Are people usually willing to talk with you?
Not necessarily. That particular day when I was at the soup kitchen trying to talk to people, I think that maybe 10 or 15 people turned me down before she was willing to talk to me.
What are their fears when they turn you down?
You know, I don't think it's fear as much as it is depression. I just don't think this, you know, American reporter comes in with this microphone and wants to know what's it like to live in Sarajevo, and it is so depressing for them, and they are so angry and so despairing that they just don't want to talk about it, least of all to some, you know, Western reporter who can come in and spend a couple of weeks in the city and go out again. I don't think they really have reason to be afraid. I make it clear to them from the beginning that they don't have to give their name, and the chances of somebody hearing an interview with them on national public radio and them somehow suffering the consequences of it are remote. So it's irrational or unreasonable for them to be afraid. And I don't think they really are afraid. I just think they don't want to talk.
Mm-hmm. So where do you stay in Sarajevo? This doesn't strike me as the kind of war where there are reporter hotels.
You're wrong. There is a reporter hotel.
Really?
You know, I think in all war zones, there are always profiteers, entrepreneurs who recognize an opportunity to make money. I don't think there's ever been a war where somebody hasn't profited from it. And foreign journalists have a lot of cash. Their news organizations are desperate to have them in there and working, and they will pay whatever it takes to be accommodated. And there is a Holiday Inn in Sarajevo that is open and functioning. It is exclusively caters to the foreign press corps. There are only about 20 or 25% of the rooms that are usable because the rest have been destroyed. It's very near the front lines, and it comes under shelling, or did in the past quite frequently, and much of the hotel has been destroyed. But the backside, which is away from the Serbian front lines, is usable. And they take hard currency, something like $80 or $90 a night. They don't give you very much for it, but you have a bed, and there are maids who come around every day and do their best to clean your room. You don't have any water, and a lot of the times you don't have any electricity or heat, but you have a safe bed to sleep in every night.
What do you do for food in Bosnia?
$80 or $90 a night that you pay the Holiday Inn, they somehow managed to get food, some kind of black market deal or something. There was some, they gave you three meals a day. It wasn't very good. There'd be some old meat and rice or something like that, instant mashed potatoes that they somehow got out of the humanitarian aid shipments, something like that. So we were okay. I personally bring a lot of vitamins when I go into Sarajevo because the diet, you get plenty to eat so you don't get hungry, but it's not a very nourishing diet. People who, unlike the rest of us foreign correspondents who don't have money, live essentially on a lot of pasta, a lot of macaroni, if they're lucky, some dried beans. It's not a very varied diet.
My guest is Tom Jelton. He's been covering the civil war in the former Yugoslavia. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is NPR foreign affairs correspondent Tom Jelton. What's it like for you to be able to get in and out of Sarajevo knowing that you're leaving people behind? You know, I'm sure so many people would love to somehow come out with you.
They would. They not only would they like to, but they ask, and they come up with these various harebrained schemes for how they could accompany you. I've had people ask me to get them accredited to NPR so that they could go out sort of in the guise of a journalist. It's difficult. I'm really not in a position to get people out. It's very difficult to get people out of Sarajevo. Some journalists have gotten their interpreters out, but it takes a lot of high-level negotiations. So I don't particularly feel guilty about not taking people out with me. It is hard to leave, though, because they are desperate for contact with the outside world. You know, this is something that people think about the dangers from shelling and the problems of not having food and so forth. But people in Sarajevo, as much as anything else, just miss contact with the outside world. They have no idea what's going on. Their radios don't work because their batteries are dead. They don't have electricity. They don't really know what's going on, and they're desperate for contact. And when I or someone else comes into the city and spend 2 or 3 or 4 weeks there and get to know them, they don't like to see us go. And it's hard for us to leave. It's hard for me or anyone to know that I can leave anytime it really gets to me. I can just get on the next aid flight out of there. And that's always a painful moment, leaving and knowing that these people with whom you've become friends are stuck there behind.
Now, I know when you were interviewing Gordana Knacevic, one of the things she said was that she was afraid she was losing her ability to think clearly. And she's a journalist. She's an editor at that Sarajevo newspaper. Has that ever been a problem for you when you've been there for extended periods of time? Or do you feel you haven't been there long enough to have that kind of feeling?
It is a problem. It's a very emotional experience to be in Sarajevo. First, you're in danger, just like everyone else is, and therefore, unlike a lot of news stories where the reporter can more or less remain dispassionate, it's much harder in Sarajevo to be detached from the story because you become, even for a limited period, as much a target of attacks and as much a victim, in a sense, as they are. And so you begin to identify with them. And therefore, when you go to write your articles or file your reports, you have to really be careful not to sort of let them turn into a kind of an emotional diatribe or something like that. And I think that some stories that I have seen coming out of Sarajevo have sort of slipped beyond that line. And a reporter gets so worked up and passionate and emotional about the situation that he's in that the reporting suffers. And it's very difficult for me to talk to my editors when I'm there. I file on a satellite phone. It's very expensive. It's up to $40 a minute. And you can't have the kind of give and take with your editors that that I would normally have in a story like that. So, you know, editors can sort of keep you under control. They can say, back off, this is a little bit too much. And when you just have to file your stories and you don't have the chance to sort of play them for an editor first, there is that danger. You have to... One has to be very careful to keep his emotions under control as much as possible, and it's hard.
Now, you just won the George Polk Award for pieces that you did that pieced together the story of a massacre of about 200 Muslim men who were taken from a detention camp in Bosnia and executed by Serb militias. What was the process for you of finding the few survivors of that massacre who helped you piece together that story? You interviewed several survivors.
Right. That was in central Bosnia. At that time, I was operating out of Split, which is a city on the Adriatic coast of Croatia, and traveling up into central Bosnia in the small portion of territory that is controlled by the Bosnian army. And at that time, there were a lot of refugees coming, essentially fleeing from the Serb forces in northern and eastern Bosnia, who were engaged in what they called ethnic cleansing operations, which is essentially pushing non-Serbs out of their villages. So every day, I went to this town called Travnik, and every day there were hundreds, literally hundreds of people coming into the town, sort of straggling over the mountains and down the road with horrific tales. And I went there basically just to get their stories. And in the process of talking to people coming across, I heard these stories of a massacre that had taken place. And it took several trips and many interviews to piece together what exactly happened. One has to be very careful in a situation like that to separate rumor from fact, because there are an awful lot of rumors that go around, stories that take on, that are larger than life, that people traumatized often imagine things to be even worse than they were. So one has to be careful. But in that case, it turned out to be true. I found a number of... I found two survivors who had come through that and told about it. Their stories corroborated each other. I was working on that story with another reporter from the Washington Post, and that is very helpful because you can serve as a check on each other and make sure that you really have the story down before you report it.
What do you look for to corroborate a story that you're piecing together like this?
You look for details. You look for little pieces of description that one survivor or witness offers that could not easily be imagined by someone else. If somebody says the same number of that the incident happened at the same place, if they describe the same place and the same circumstances, the same number of buses, the same procedure, then it of course takes on a lot more credibility.
Are there authorities, Serbian authorities in this case, that you speak to get the official story?
Yes, and in that case, fortunately, the Serb police chief of Banja Luka, which is the largest Serb-controlled city in that area, confirmed that a massacre had taken place on the day and in the place that we knew. I think that we were very fortunate in that regard. For his own reasons, I think he wanted to separate himself, to distance himself from what he considered extremist elements or out-of-control elements. And so I guess he considered it in his interest to say that evidently did in fact take place and that they were conducting an investigation and so forth. Sometimes, to be perfectly honest, it's hardly worth talking to the authorities on that side, because if they don't want you to know about it, they just won't talk about it at all. In this case, fortunately, he decided to confirm it.
What do you think the importance is of a story like this, where you find that there was a massacre of 200 Muslim men? What's the importance of getting out a story like that?
Well, the circumstances of that killing resemble so much the killings that took place in Europe 50 years ago. It's stories like that that I think get people's attention and make them realize that what's happening in Bosnia today is comparable in many ways to what happened 50 years ago in Europe. It's incidents like lining 200 young boys up at the edge of a cliff and shooting them and letting their bodies tumble over the edge down into the ravine. That it's stories like that that people, I think, associate with the Second World War more than conflicts nowadays. So it's important that people understand that we're not talking about just another local conflict here. We're talking about a war with a brutality that has been unseen in Europe in 50 years.
You said that, sometimes it's not even worth it to talk to the Serbian authorities. What were some of the lies that you've been told by Serbian authorities?
Lies?
Yeah.
Well, that same police chief told us that the Muslims who had left Banja Luka, or the cities, villages surrounding, had done so for economic reasons, gone off to other places in Western Europe where they had rich relatives who were taking care of them, that they were not forced out of town, that it was a voluntary migration on their part. And that, I don't hesitate in saying it, that is a complete lie. What happened in those villages was brutal depopulation with thousands of people killed. Serb forces came in, and those people who were not killed in the initial attack, who were not driven, who did not run for their lives into the woods, were forced out. Serb forces would come into their houses and burn their houses down around them, steal everything they owned, and load them onto trucks and haul them out of there. We heard these stories like this dozens of times. And for him to say that this was just some kind of voluntary migration of people leaving for better circumstances elsewhere is really hogwash. And more recently, I was in eastern Bosnia in the town of Zvornik, which before the war had 67% Muslim population. And now virtually every Muslim has been driven out of that town. The mosque has been burned down. The mayor, the so-called mayor of Zvornik now, gave us a very similar story, that the people there just left on their own accord. And what in fact had happened in Zvornik about a year ago this month was one of the most brutal depopulation campaigns that one could imagine.
So what did you say to this police chief when he told you that people just, decided to leave the town?
I didn't say anything. You don't argue with them mm-hmm. like that. You just record that and you put that on the air. And I think that when I reported what he said, I included some kind of comment like to make it clear that in my judgment that this was baloney.
Tom Jelton is a foreign affairs correspondent for NPR. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Tom Jelton will be back with us to talk more about reporting from Bosnia in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, reporting under fire. We continue our conversation with NPR's Tom Gjelten about his experiences covering the Civil War in the former Yugoslavia. He'll tell us about the dangers faced by reporters in Bosnia, and we'll discuss the options under consideration by the Clinton administration and the UN. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton says that Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic is engaging in a charm offensive in order to head off tougher UN sanctions aimed at his nation. But Mr. Clinton admitted that he was frustrated at the inability of the West to put an end to Serbian aggression. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In a newspaper interview today, Milosevic praised the president's policies, saying he appreciates that the U.S. is not trying to be the world's policeman. President Clinton said Milosevic is only trying to head off further sanctions and will not be successful. The U.S. is pushing Serbia to agree to a U.N.-brokered peace agreement, and Mr. Clinton said the U.S. could do more to make life uncomfortable for the Serbs if they don't go along. But at a news conference, the president admitted there are no easy answers.
It is a difficult situation. It is the most difficult and most frustrating problem in the world today.
The United States has been working in concert with its Western allies and the UN. The president said he has not thought the U.S. should take unilateral action, but that he hasn't ruled anything in or out. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
At today's White House press conference, President Clinton said he believes that Arab-Israeli peace talks will resume this month. And Egyptian President Mubarak said he has great hopes they will continue. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The peace talks were stalled by Israel's decision to deport some 400 Palestinians from the occupied territories in December. Israel now says 100 can come back immediately and the rest by the end of the year. But so far, that's not enough for the Palestinian delegation to the talks. President Clinton insisted today Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has made sufficient concessions on this issue. President Mubarak says he'll continue his efforts to convince the Palestinians to return to the table.
We have good contacts with Mr. Rabin. I'm used to exchange views with him. And whatever's convenient to help the peace process to start, the negotiations to continue, I'm doing it.
A senior U.S. official said comprehensive and meaningful assurances are being offered that will allow the Palestinians to return to the talks. But the assurances take effect only after the Palestinians say yes. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
President Clinton has indicated that he is willing to compromise on his economic stimulus package to create jobs, a plan that is stalled by Republican lawmakers in the Senate. Speaking at a White House news conference, Mr. Clinton accused GOP lawmakers of playing politics, but said that he would work to modify his $16 billion package to meet some objections. The president said that he still supports the idea of a jobs package and hopes when Congress comes back from its spring break, they will approve such a measure. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 2 points to close at 3,377.57, on volume of more than 290 million shares. This is NPR News. In Los Angeles, both sides have rested their case in the federal trial of four L.A. police officers accused of beating Rodney King. The judge in the trial says that the case may go to the jury by Friday afternoon. The defendants are accused of violating King's civil rights in the beating at the end of a high-speed traffic chase. Acquittals in the state trial set off 3 days of rioting. The government projected today that the Social Security system should remain in good financial shape through the 21st century. But the forecast for Medicare, the nation's health insurance program for senior citizens, was not as reassuring. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports.
The report says Medicare could run out of money to pay hospital bills for senior citizens in just 6 years. Today, 34 million older Americans rely on Medicare for health benefits. Despite recent cost-cutting efforts, it's one of the nation's fastest-growing social programs. The portion of Medicare that pays for doctor care is solvent right now. That program is financed through a combination of general revenues and monthly contributions from seniors themselves. It's the hospital portion of Medicare that's a problem. That's financed by payroll taxes. And those revenues aren't keeping pace with spending for growing numbers of older people, along with advances in costly technology. Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala says the dismal economic prediction only dramatizes the need for major reform of the nation's health care system. I'm Patricia Namond reporting.
Officials in Moscow say that a tank of radioactive waste exploded and burned at a weapons plant in Siberia today, and firefighters were exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. Officials say the explosion also contaminated a large area. It's not clear just how much radiation was released in the accident. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Tom Gelton is back with us to tell us more about his experiences covering the civil war in the former Yugoslavia. Gelton is a foreign affairs correspondent for NPR. He also covered the Gulf War and conflicts in Central America. Are journalists targets in Bosnia?
That's hard to say, and journalists themselves disagree on that. You know, when I first went into Sarajevo and the war zone in Bosnia last summer, we all put the letters TV on the sides of our cars in colored tape or reflective tape because that's sort of the international symbol of a journalist. And we did that in the idea that if they knew we were journalists, they wouldn't shoot at us. And I think generally at that time, we felt that that did give us some protection. Now, journalists don't do that anymore. Because I guess we've come to the conclusion that, in fact, they see a car with the letters TV on it, they single it out. But you never can tell. I mean, in a war zone, who knows what people are thinking? And I'm sure that there are some factions that, in fact, are more sophisticated about the importance of the international press and do try to protect them to some extent and spare them the worst things, knowing that if they make the press their enemy, that it'll just make the situation worse. On the other hand, there are a lot of elements that I am convinced do shoot specifically at journalists. There have been a number of incidents where journalists were clearly targeted. The ABC TV producer, David Kaplan, who was killed in Sarajevo last August, was traveling in a van, very clearly marked press. The bullet hole, the bullet that killed him, went right between the letters T and V in the vehicle. So in that instance, he was clearly targeted. But it's hard to say whether there's a general pattern or not.
I've heard several journalists say that this war is a particularly dangerous war to cover. Now, you've covered wars in El Salvador, the war in the Gulf. Do you find this war more dangerous or dangerous in a different way than other wars that you've covered?
It is far more dangerous. But not necessarily because we're targeted. It's what's different about this war is that a far, far higher percentage of casualties are civilian casualties. Something like 60% of the casualties in Bosnia have been civilian. This is far higher, many times higher than in the Gulf or in Central America. And as a reporter, we are civilians and we're working among civilians. It's just a much more dangerous place to be.
So what precautions do you take when you're reporting from Bosnia that are different from the precautions that you took when you were reporting from Central America?
Well, I never had protective clothing in Central America. I wear this huge and very heavy bulletproof vest in Bosnia, and a lot of reporters have helmets. I don't personally have a helmet yet because I think there's some, if you wear a helmet, you look too much like a soldier, so I'm not sure that that's a good idea. There were no armored cars in Central America, so those sort of minimum protection measures are taken in Bosnia that were not taken in other wars generally. But there's not a lot you can do. You just have to be far more careful about where you go, and you pay more attention to on days, for example, in Sarajevo, when there's a lot of shelling, I basically stay in my hotel room. I just don't go out.
Well, I'm sure you've learned to recognize the sound of incoming shells and other weapons. What do you do when you hear one starting to whistle by?
Well, once if you hear one whistling by, you're okay. It means it's already gone by. The ones you have to worry about are the ones you don't hear. They do sometimes come in sequence. So if something explodes close by you, or if you hear something whistling by, you try to take shelter. It's a difficult thing. There was a time when I was at the Bosnian Presidency building when a shell landed in front of the building on a group of people, and about a dozen people were injured and several people were killed. And I was inside the building, and I could hear the screams from the people outside. And I thought to myself, this is the reality of this war. And as a journalist, I should describe this scene, and I should even document it. And yet, I didn't go out there. I didn't go out there to see what had happened or to record the sounds of the scene, because people around me were warning me not to. Often, as I say, the shells will come in sequence. And I think I might have described it in copy, but I didn't go out there in a circumstance. Some other journalists might have, but I actually tend to be very cautious in my movements.
Did you think it might have been voyeuristic, too, to have a microphone
Yes.
turned on so many people who are in agony?
Yes and no. I think one can certainly be discreet in a situation like that. You don't go up with a microphone, you know, to someone who is in agony and record their sounds. But you can sort of stay at a distance and mm-hmm. just sort of make some kind of general recording just in order to provide a background in this of the scene. But that's not the reason I didn't do it, Terry, because I think that in that case, it would have been. I think it's really important that people understand how horrible this is, and
yeah.
I wouldn't have hesitated for that reason. One can do that with discretion. I hesitated because I thought it was too dangerous.
Well, it's important to do that. That way, you're around to record the next thing that happens.
Right.
Is that the closest you've come to being hit yourself?
I had an experience last summer where I was driving. At that time, we still drove from the airport into the city in soft-skinned cars. I had my own car, and this was the day the airport was opened, put under UN control, and there were a convoy of us who were going back to the city together, probably 8 or 10 press vehicles, and we came under fire on the road, and there were bullets whizzing all around, and the car behind me got hit. And I saw in my rearview mirror that they had been hit. And I started driving pretty wildly at that point. That's actually the closest that I ever came.
Who was in the car behind you that was hit?
It was a VizNews crew, which is a... They gather tape, videotape, for a lot of television networks and sell it to television networks around the world. I think there might have been somebody from ITN, the British TV crew, in there as well. Fortunately, nobody was injured, but their windows were all blown out.
What effect does it have on your interest in continuing to report from Bosnia when someone who you know or someone physically close to you has been, injured or killed?
It has the effect of making me a lot more cautious. On that particular day, there were two journalists shot, and they were doing exactly what we were all doing. They were driving from the airport to the city, and I knew them. One was a reporter for Libération, the French newspaper. He was shot in the leg and ultimately lost his leg. And with him was a photographer for The Observer, which is a London newspaper. I knew him a little better. And he was kind of a cowboy type, full of bravado. And I went to see him in the hospital the next day. And he was curled up in his hospital bed in a fetal position. And he was in a lot of pain and he was whimpering. And there was something about that experience that just sickened me, and you know, to see... I think there are a lot of journalists who consider themselves invulnerable, and then they are just in a matter of moments reduced to this sort of whimpering mass in a hospital bed, and that really had a big impact on me. I didn't want to find myself in that situation, and I think there's a lot of stupidity, and I don't hesitate using that word, on the part of journalists in Sarajevo who kind of get off on the drama and risk of it without ever taking into consideration how much danger they're really in and how their lives will be permanently changed if they're not careful.
So this experience made you more cautious?
It certainly did.
Maybe a lot of people, too, are trying to make their reputation by doing something incredibly daring.
Yes. But, you know, another thing I noticed about that experience is that those two guys, the day before, you know, we were a press pack. Everybody sort of travels together and gets together at night and goes out, or doesn't go out for dinner, but eats, you know, together and maybe shares what they have. And there's a lot of camaraderie. And the day after that, these two guys are gone. They're just not there anymore. You know, one is in the hospital, one is being evacuated. And nobody seems to notice. I mean, not that many people even went to see him in the hospital. And it was amazing to me how two people can just disappear from the press corps like that, and no one seems to even take notice.
Tom Jelton is my guest, foreign affairs correspondent for NPR. He's been covering the war in the former Yugoslavia and, in fact, just won a George Polk Award for his reporting from Bosnia. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is NPR reporter Tom Jelton, and we're talking about his work covering the war in the former Yugoslavia. Having seen the results of the war, the suffering, the death, the injury, I'm sure you ask yourself all the time what could possibly explain the strength of the anti-Muslim feelings that have enabled Serbs to massacre, to rape, to destroy whole towns. What kind of answer do you come up with for that?
There are a couple of answers. One is that these feelings are not new. There was horrible killing in Yugoslavia during the Second World War. And while it was not carried out exclusively along national lines, there were patterns that corresponded to national lines. Serbs, the partisan forces, tended to be primarily Serbs. And the forces that are known as the Ustasha, the sort of the pro-Nazi forces, had more than their share of Muslims in them. And therefore, people with memories of what happened 50 years ago or who have been told of what happened 50 years ago have these old animosities. But those animosities themselves do not explain what has happened, because Bosnia has been in peace for 50 years, and people have, to a great extent, gotten over these old hatreds. What was necessary was demagogic politicians who could come in and exploit feelings of discontent, social tensions, economic problems, and a scapegoat, which is something that politicians, demagogues, have done for centuries. But I think it's important that people understand that that this isn't simply a return to old hatreds. It really took manipulation by politicians to go from that point to the kind of killing that has taken place.
Do you think this is a war in which the good guys and bad guys are clear-cut?
No, I don't. I think that from time to time, there are... my reporting has been much harder on the Serb forces than on either the Croatian forces or the Muslim forces, and that's because I think the Serb forces have been responsible for more than their share of atrocities. But Muslim forces have also carried out atrocious things, and certainly the Croats have as well. It's a real challenge to get this story straight, because on the one hand, you don't want the listener to just sort of view this as some kind of Balkan craziness where everybody is a bad guy and it has something to do with the land or the environment that produces these old hatreds. There are patterns, and the Serb forces have, in more cases than not, been responsible for the worst things that have happened. But on the other hand, while making that clear, you don't want to oversimplify it either, and you don't want the listener to get this black and white idea that the Serbs are all bad and the Croats and Muslims are all good. It's a real challenge.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher said that he will push for permission to send arms to Bosnian Muslims if the Serbs continue to resist peace efforts. What do you see happening if the arms embargo is lifted?
Not necessarily anything. It's true that the imbalance in weaponry between the Bosnian side and the Serb side is the single biggest determining factor in this war. But lifting the arms embargo is not necessarily going to change that imbalance, because you still have to get those big, heavy weapons into the Bosnian side. And how are you going to get... What they need is tanks, and they need big artillery pieces. And how are you going to get tanks into Sarajevo? You're just not going to be able to do it. It's not a problem of the embargo. It's a problem of having no access to the city. The UN is not going to turn over its airport to be a staging area for weapons deliveries to the Bosnian government. That would violate the terms under which the airport was opened in the first place. Either the Serb or the Croat forces in Bosnia control all the major access routes into central Bosnia. And neither of those sides is going to allow tanks to be transported down those roads. So I'm afraid that the embargo is not really the issue. Lifting the arms embargo could mean they'll get some small arms and ammunition, but I don't see that that's going to enable them to get the tanks and big pieces that they really need.
Do you think the Vance Owen peace plan is dead?
Yes, I do. I think I was just in eastern Bosnia about 10 days ago, and as I said, this is one of the regions that's been set aside for the Muslims. There's not a Muslim to be found there right now. It is totally under the control of the Serb army, and it's unimaginable to me that even 60 or 70,000 NATO troops, which is what is being talked about, would be sufficient to somehow force the Serbs to leave that province and to see it somehow repopulated with Muslims. This is, I'm afraid, in that part of Bosnia, the war is over. The Serbs won, the Muslims lost, and no peace plan is going to change that.
The UN Security Council is going to vote on tighter sanctions on Serbia, although they're going to delay the vote until after the referendum in Russia. Do you have any hopes for that? Is there anything you do have hopes for?
I don't have any illusions that that's going to change the situation. The sanctions have, if anything, strengthened the position of the ruling class in Serbia, and in many cases even enriched them financially. People in Belgrade now are more united behind their government than they were a year ago. It's harder to find people who speak out against the war. It's harder to find people who speak out against the government. People are definitely being hurt and they're suffering, but they feel that this is all unjust, that the world is against them, and if the sanctions are tightened, I think that effect will just be more pronounced. I guess the West is just frustrated, wants to do something, and it can't come up with any better idea than tightening sanctions. But tightening sanctions isn't going to do a thing to stop this war.
My guest Tom Gjelten has been covering the civil war in the former Yugoslavia for NPR. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. The president of Egypt was in Washington today. Let's see how they're covering that on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. President Mubarak and President Clinton met at the White House, and they talked, among other things, about the threat of terrorism from Iran. Also, President Clinton has strong words of warning to the Bosnian Serbs and to Serbia. Signed the Vance Owen peace plan, he says, or the allies will make life very uncomfortable for the Serbs in Serbia. We'll talk with Kate Ady of the BBC from the Muslim town Tuzla in Bosnia. A political scientist offers this theory. Go ahead and divide Bosnia into three sections, Croat, Serb, and Muslim. It would indeed reward the Serbs for their aggression, but his argument is it would avoid further bloodshed.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. NPR Foreign Affairs correspondent Tom Gjelten is my guest. Now, you started your career as a teacher and a principal on an island in Maine. You even wrote a book about that called Schooling in Isolated Communities.
Now, how did you find that out, Terry?
Oh, from your a press release about you, actually. Oh. I mean, it was really simple to find that out. But I mean, how did you get from there to
not only journalism, but to becoming a war correspondent. It really seems like a very far distance to go.
Well, it is. I started out, though, in college back at the University of Minnesota as a journalist, determined to become a journalist. I worked on the Minnesota Daily, was one of the editors. And then I took this detour into teaching. But I never taught anywhere else except on this island off the coast of Maine. And I almost saw myself even there as something like a cultural anthropologist, which was my major, incidentally.
Uh-huh.
And that book that I wrote, I wrote it sort of halfway from the perspective of an outsider, sort of describing what I saw there. So there was a lot of that book had a strong journalistic quality to it. And so even though I was working as a teacher, I think in the back of the mind, I always felt somewhat like an anthropologist or a journalist or something like that. So it was very easy for me to return after that to journalism. When I left the island, I went back to journalism in the first place as an education journalist. I was a freelance education writer for a few years, and I had in college done a lot of traveling overseas, spent a lot of time in Central America, and as an education writer, I did a lot of writing about international education, and was hired at NPR in the end as an education reporter. But I spoke Spanish, and I'd always spoken Spanish, and NPR called on me a couple of times to go to Central America, took me off my education beat to send me to Central America because I did speak Spanish and had experience in the region, and I just sort of drifted back into foreign reporting that way.
Is there anything that, in your experience, that prepared you for being a war correspondent?
No, I still don't feel like I'm well prepared for it. It's not something that a sane person can prepare for.
You're going back to Berlin, which is your home base, sometime in around 24 hours, and then soon after that you're going to go back to Sarajevo. How do you feel looking ahead to that? I mean, are you looking forward to going back to Sarajevo?
No, I'm not looking forward to going back to Sarajevo, but, you know, coming back to the States on this trip, I have realized that a lot of people hear my reports and that they may even make a difference. And this is something that is important to a journalist, to feel that his reporting matters. And I've never, I don't think, covered a story where I had such a sense of my reports actually mattering in some way. And this is a war that has affected me personally like no other story before it has. And therefore, I feel some commitment to going back. It sounds, I don't want to make it sound maudlin, but you know, this is a really daunting assignment that I feel like I have, and so I feel a commitment to this story like I haven't felt on other occasions.
Tom, thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck when you go back.
Thank you, Terry. It's nice to talk to you.
Tom Gelton is a foreign affairs correspondent for NPR. He just won a George Polk Award for his reporting from Bosnia. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Bill Duhart. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times columnist Anna Quinlan tells us why she continues to wear her gender on her sleeve. She has a new collection of columns called Thinking Out Loud on the personal, the political, the public, and the private. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.